All right, so here I am. I broke out the super high-end bio photo. It's my official corporate photo in front of the infamous 80s laser background. If we have 80s kids here, everyone knows the 80s background. So yeah, a little bit about me. I presented at Last Hope 2 years ago. Boy, it seems like it was yesterday. I live up in Poughkeepsie. I'm originally from Long Island. Yes, bacon, egg, and cheese sandwiches are a culinary delicacy of the area. I enjoy those thusly. And I like all things wireless. I'm not just about amateur radio. I know some people think that amateur radio is some kind of weird cult. It's not, but if you want to drop me details, I know from giving presentations, everyone always asks, will the slides be available? And what's the way that you contact me? So here you go. I'm giving you the email address. Please don't spam me. And there we go. So onwards and upwards. So the way that I thought about this presentation was to break this into kind of four parts. We're talking about things that fly and send wireless signals. So we're going to be looking at four general things: birds, drones, planes, and balloons. And so after each of these sections, the way that I set it up is we could take a couple questions before moving on. I think it's Friday, 4 o'clock. We probably all appreciate efficiency. So that's the plan. So the first topic we'll go through is what's called MODIS, followed by RID, followed by an alphabet soup of acronyms relating to aircraft, and then finally we'll wrap up with radio sonde and high altitude balloon stuff. So why do I think that this is a topic? I think it actually relates pretty well to the prior presenter. So maybe we'll play off each other a little bit. But since I've been a kid, I grew up in Bethpage, where Grumman is, and two things were always omnipresent: airplanes, and if anyone knows about the big blue ball radar that Grumman had, wireless. It was like always in my backyard. So from an early age, I always thought the two things were interesting. As a career, I spent a lot of time these days around big data and data visualization. So it's kind of like a really cool combination. So as you could see, flying things I think are pretty interesting. Meh, interesting. But I think flying things that transmit radio waves are more interesting. Flying things that transmit unencrypted radio waves are even more interesting. Really highlighting unencrypted here. Ground stations and massive databases of received radio waves are really interesting. We're not really going to have time to talk about encrypted stuff, but you can catch me offline and we could chat about other things. But this is the goal of the presentation. So how do we get started receiving these waves? These are the two things that I will say most people probably have. Does anyone have a SDR dongle? Just quick show of hands. Okay, awesome. And then who has like some SV32 LoRa mesh-tastic something or other? All right, so we'll convert the rest of you soon enough into that part of the wireless cult. But the idea is, you know, for roughly about $50 between the two, you're going to have some really interesting capabilities. One thing that I have sprinkled out through the presentation, because I know that people love to take photos of slides. Let's see how good your cameras are. Oh, hopefully I don't block the QR code. So there we go. So just to kind of break it down, I'm not going to go through this. You could kind of get an idea for the thumbs up and the thumbs down. Here's those two devices. These are but these are known to be quality for the price, and through these sellers, you always have to be careful. I think we've all learned, you try to do the AliExpress route to save $2.23. Please don't do it. Just buy the legitimate, and these are the options that I'd say. But yeah, basically between these two devices, here's kind of how this is gonna marry out to what you're gonna see in the presentation. So grab these QR codes. Can I just get a quick show? Has anyone successfully decoded a QR code? All right. Awesome. Hey, technology's great. All right. So I'll be coming back to this, you know, periodically, but hopefully this gives you an idea. There's not one perfect device, but between these two, you have a lot of really cool capability. Are there better devices? Yes. Are there things that are more expensive? Yes. But again, looks like a bunch of you have this stuff already. So what I bet that most of you don't have is the correct antenna. Most of you, I'm gonna guess, have like these weird little telescoping antennas that came with it. You get all cranky that all you could receive with your SDR is like local FM broadcast and some cranky ham radio people on a local repeater. Please get the right antennas. If anyone has seen me walking around with my little Lego pal in the lobby area over there, antennas are a passion of mine. So the right antenna for the right thing is super important. So I just want to reinforce that right from the beginning, that if you are going to play around with what we're going to go through, don't expect miracles from telescoping included craptastic antennas. So you're going to want to look at the right antenna for the right frequency and the right application. All right, so first up, we're going to talk about what is called MODIS. I bet hardly anyone here has ever heard of MODIS. It is not an acronym. It's actually Latin for the word movement or motion. So that's where it comes from. There's been lots of different ways that wildlife folks have tracked wildlife over the years, going back, you know, 50, 60, 70, maybe even 80 years in some form or fashion. But, you know, these days, the largest program on the planet is called MODIS. What makes MODIS special, because Canada is great, they've worked across the world to come up with unified frequencies. And so this is actually helpful for maybe those of us that want to monitor these, makes it easy. But for those that are doing things in the field, it also lowers some costs. So that, I think, is one of the biggest things. But as you can see on the bottom, there's a lot of cool things. And MODIS has not been around for many, many years. But because it hasn't really been made very public, just to kind of throw some data points out here, I guess I'll just keep doing this. So countries with MODIS receiver sites, 34 countries, over 2,000 receiver stations, 371 species, 46,000 animals, 800 different projects, lots of people behind it, 2,300 people, you know, involved. The point is, this is massive scale. When you have massive scale type of projects, you have massive amounts of data, and that's what we're going to kind of get into. So here is the current deployment map of receiver sites. I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but those magical three frequencies, ooh, that we see up at the right-hand side, those are the three frequencies. It's really one and a half, I'd say. The first one, 166, is the most common. But the 434 frequency is growing in popularity, not too much on 2.4 gigahertz. Most people know 2.4 is around Wi-Fi, so hasn't really caught on, but just kind of a local, you know, picture as to how many of these MODIS ground stations exist right here on Long Island. We're about 9. Connecticut has 17, Hudson Valley area, which is quite large, is 7, and North Jersey, home of Taylor pork roll, among other delicacies, is around 10. So there's a bunch of these ground stations. The way that you want to kind of think about these, the way that these ground stations get funded is mostly through academia. So if there's schools that are focused on ecology and environment, chances are they probably have some coursework that could relate to this. There's also a lot of other societies like Audubon and people into birds and stuff like that. So there's lots of different organizations that create these ground stations. If you could see how this this map is a little different than the other one, where it looks like we have like these weird little butterfly type of things. The way that you want to think about these ground stations and how they detect birds is almost like a tripwire. So when a bird flies past the antenna beam width, that's how they know that there's birds that are coming past it. So most of these are dual band. So the difference between the yellow and the green is the VHF and the UHF frequencies. But every ground station has a different purpose for what it entails. So if we're thinking local here on Long Island on the South Shore, down at the bottom, we can see that, I guess that's like Long Beach area-ish. So there's lots of birds like nesting, piping clovers and whatnot that are endangered species down there. So they want to make sure, where are they coming from? Most importantly, birds hopefully don't get in the flight path of airplanes. So you'll notice a correlation if you took a map of major airports and these ground stations, they strangely overlap. So kind of consider that a good thing. But yeah, that's a little bit about the ground station side. And then what does a ground station look like? Boy, you know, we know Montauk and Boise, Idaho are like peas in a pod, right? So these are just two examples. Has anyone been out to Montauk Camp Hero? Anyone know where that is? Okay, so that photo that I have it right, if anyone knows where the bluffs are, to the east of the bluffs, there is a large receiver site. This was taken from satellite view. It's probably one of the larger stations because it's actually really important for different birds that migrate to and fro to Europe. So that's a really important one. And then just to kind of give a better up close view is this one in Boise, Idaho. You could tell it's just like a solar panel with some 2x4s and an equipment cabinet with the antennas. So that's basically what a ground station looks like. All the signals from these ground stations do ultimately get ported back out over the internet, which I'll show you next. But what do these little transmitters look like? Birds, most birds, are pretty tiny. If we look all the way over at left, there's a US penny. So for scale, I tried to match things up pretty good. We're talking tiny, because again, they're going on birds. Here we have a dime with some other smaller ones. So again, these are really tiny. And what we're looking at on that map over there is this is a Eastern whippoorwill. And this data I just pulled off the other day. So the way that this works is a bird will have a transmitter attached to it that's tagged by a wildlife professional. No, you don't go and buy these and attach them to birds yourself. Please do not do that. But these are for professionals to do this. And they track these. So what's kind of neat is this specific bird has a ID tag. So the way that these transmit, it doesn't have a GPS, but since we're just thinking of the ground stations as like a tripwire, every time that that bird has flown past these, it's automatically uploaded via the ground station network, and you can go to the MODIS website and take a look at this data. And so here we can see that for some reason, this particular bird loves to spend most of its time in Rhode Island, but then sometimes like to goes down to the Jersey Shore, and for some reason likes to make part of its home in Washington, D.C. I don't know who wants to do that, but we'll keep politics out of this. You know, here we could see, you know, for 2 years, you know, basically almost what's the flight path of this bird. I think that's pretty cool. Now, imagine if we're doing this for hundreds, if not thousands of birds and other animals. So, you know, just to give a sense, and you can go and grab this. You can go to the MODIF website and you could look at all this, maybe wherever you live, see what birds, if any, are tagged and tracked. So this is pretty cool. Here we have at the opposite end of the spectrum, this is one of the largest butterflies, but yeah, this is like CIA level spec ops stuff, right? You know, super tiny transmitter that can fit in the size of a US quarter. Currently we're around 2,700 birds that are tracked, which is the most. This is a sandpiper, followed by bats. There's a little brown bat. There's 646 of them tracked. And monarch butterflies, most of all insects right now, they're up to 423. So next time that you see a butterfly going past you, if you look at it carefully, you might see something and know it was not a CIA kind of like deep cover thing. It's like a MODIS project. So something to kind of keep an eye out for. So getting to the end of MODIS, I'm not going to go through these because I think I kind of covered these for the most part. So we talked about ground stations. Cool thing with the ground stations is the antennas are very directional. So most ground stations have four receivers. If anyone's into war driving, I would equate this to kind of like interesting for people that might be into war driving, maybe doing something different, but from a fixed location. So you do need a bunch of different receivers, which are again, the same SDRs that you're all using. That's what these professionals are using to receive and pipe things in. The SDR is connected to like a Raspberry Pi. It runs a software pack down here called SensorGnome. I think that's the QR code. Somebody can validate it for me. If you hit that QR code, it should bring you to the SensorGnome on Git, and you can learn a little bit more about that. You can set up your own ground station if you want. All the details are there on the MODIS.org site, as well as other details. So again, I think this is like really cool. You know, if more people get involved in the MODIS project through official organizations, I think we have a lot of good community and planet benefit, you know, if all it is. All right. Thank you. So yeah, I think, you know, if we can get more people involved in this, I think, you know, it's something that we kind of owe back to the planet. You know, if we have a better understanding for our wildlife and their habits, you know, that might be some good predictors of the future. So hopefully all those indicators are positive. But there we go on MODIS. And now we're ready for Q&A on MODIS. Is there any questions? If not, we could chug on. Yeah, so the question is there software out there? The answer is yes. So if you go to SensorNome, if you just want to do a search for that, SensorNome is the software that you could use to decode this, again, because they're unified frequencies. You could connect that to like a Raspberry Pi. You could run it on like a regular computer. Again, the key thing is antenna, but software. SensorNome is probably the best one. There's a couple other splinter projects on Git, which is mostly all open source, but really easy stuff. Yes. Yeah, so the frequencies are protected. So in the US, you know, we have this beast of an organization called the FCC. They kind of say what frequencies we should be using things for. These are protected. So things generally in like the 166 megahertz range are like usually federally licensed users. The interesting thing though on 434, for those that are ham radio operators, 434 in the United States and pretty much everywhere in the world, that's part of amateur radio spectrum. And so in that 433, 434 range, there's ISM devices. So everything needs to be low power, and any devices need to deal with interference from other users. And so other users can include ham radio people that are trying to bounce signals off of a moon or satellites and stuff like that, which are in that range usually. But we're also talking about things like wireless temperature sensors and weather stations and door alarms and all these other things in that. So that's why there's a combination of the two frequencies. In the rest of the world, yeah, again, this is all like, you know, try to mandate this because what happens if a bird from here goes past Montauk Point and wants to go and spend that summer in Spain? They need to have ground stations that are on the same. And then the second question on how long do the batteries last? It depends on the animal being tracked. Some of these can last for a couple of years because once they catch one of these to tag, they usually don't touch it again. Sometimes they don't last as long. It depends on what their application is. The faster that it transmits, then the less battery life it's going to have. And so that's why this tripwire approach is actually pretty cool because they don't really care down to the day, to the hour, to the second when a particular animal crosses. They just want to kind of generally know. And so chances are if it transmits like a ping like once every 6 hours or 8 hours or 10 hours, chances are they'll have an idea. So some of these could actually last for quite a couple of years. Anything else? Bueller? No? All right, on we go. All right, RID. All right, so this was as close as I can get to flying a drone inside St. John's. So we can say that we accomplished that feat. And I did a barrel roll, and now we'll just let that disappear here. Again, I spare no expense for this presentation. Yeah, there was something big that finally happened. It was pushed back a couple of times, but as of March 16th of this year, all drones in the United States need to be compliant with FAA Remote Identification, or RID for short. The way that the ruling is set up is across three categories. Before I go through these, are there any Part 107 drone pilots here in the audience? One, two, he seems not sure in the white shirt. Yes? Okay. All right. So it looks like there's like four or five of us. So somebody I was talking with a little bit earlier today about drones, who I believe is in the audience, but I'm not going to say who it is, but I said I would mention him if it mattered. So let's say if somebody was flying a drone in Houston, Texas after a storm or something. If you do not have a drone without built-in remote ID, that is something not good right now. If you have a DJI drone, and I'll steer clear of politics as far as I could possibly separate myself. Most drones you can update that have been made in the past like couple of years, most of them you cannot. So then your option is either A, if you have a drone, even if you do not have a Part 107 license, you still either have to have it transmit a remote ID on its own, or you have to buy a little device that attaches to your drone and that will be how it gets compliant with RID. Or the third option, which because I think we all don't like to be told what to do, is you can go to where there's an FAA recognized flight area where you can fly your drone. And those are actually pretty good because it's safe. The FAA knows that there's going to be drones. This is like no different than people who are into like rocketry or RC planes and stuff like that. So there are protected areas. If you're in one of those areas, you do not need to be any level of compliance with an RID. But those are the three things that you need to be compliant. If you are flying a drone, you can go to uasdoc.faa.gov/list-documents. No, sorry, I didn't put the QR code in here. Yeah, you definitely got to read up on the regs. You know, the last thing you want to do is to get in trouble. Local PD is one thing, but if you become a nuisance and you have the FAA visit you, they're probably pretty scary. So let's not go there. So again, it's like the FAA. Star Trek fans, that's why I have the Borg. You know, we must comply. You must assimilate. Ha, ha, ha. All right. So what exactly is RID? So what's transmitted? It's the serial number of the device. So by device, it could be the little external RID device or you're actually drone. So whatever the serial number is, that's going to get transmitted. The location of the drone, so like latitude and longitude as well as altitude, so all three dimensions, that's going to get transmitted. The velocity, the speed of which the drone is traveling gets transmitted. What's really neat is the control station location and elevation. So let's say if I'm flying a drone, and I'm standing here on the stage and my drone is a half mile away from here, it's taking my GPS from my phone. It's then taking that location of me, passing it back up to the RID device, and then rebroadcasting it down. And I'll get into this on the next slide, but that's actually really important. It's also transmitting the time and whatever the emergency status is. This is all transmitted over Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, mostly over Bluetooth. So if you don't have an SB32 device, everybody in this room, I can guarantee, has a receiver, because your cell phone has Bluetooth and Wi-Fi. You can download an app, such as Drone Scanner. Again, love those QR codes. So you can download an app like Drone Scanner. This is on Android. There's various Apple versions for those in that ecosystem. And so again, if you're in range, you will see the location of other drone operators. You'll see the location of yours and other drones. You'll see all the details about the drone, and you're also gonna see all the details about the operator. So next time you're in like Central Park or somewhere, open up this app on your phone. You never know what you're gonna see. So people can fly drones up to 400 feet. You might be surprised. You might pick some interesting things up, and you might actually see where those people are. I have heard rumors that there are certain people who obscure their location in Central Park, as an example. If somebody sees where they are, you know, let's call it a Karen, if that's okay. Let's say a Karen says, oh no, there's somebody flying a drone, and they run over to the red dot on the map and they find out that that red dot is actually not there. There are some drone pilots that actually do that to obscure for their own safety. But I think that's actually a bad thing to do because it puts the general public in some level of danger. So there are drones, like I said, that you can enable the RID function. Those that do not have that, you have to buy this little out device. This is approximately the same size of a US quarter. This is one of mine. I took the cover off. Looks like most things that you'd expect. In a tiny little package, it's actually kind of creepy. It's almost like a weird little tracking device. Ooh. It has a GPS and a Bluetooth transmitter and a microcontroller and a battery in it. And so it's basically using the GPS in here to rebroadcast that. Again, it's not physically, or I should say physically, it's attached to your drone. It's not electrically connected. There are versions that can electrically connect to drones, but this otherwise is 100% independent, powered everything from the drone. So you do need to have this if you want to be in compliance. I have played around with it, just for those that are wondering. If you took one of these and like you attach it to your dog and let it run around the yard, it also makes like a cool tracking application. Again, probably you shouldn't do that, but just saying, if you were looking for some kind of a device to track something locally that's not like an Apple AirTag or whatever, if you have $90 to burn, then go ahead and buy one of these or figure out how to make your own. And that's what we talk about next. So open drone ID on Git, of course, with my favorite QR code. I would expect that everyone should be taking their phones out to scan. This is probably one of the better QR codes on here. So yeah, basically you go on Amazon, you buy like a cheap SB32 device. You could buy the one that I mentioned earlier on. You could buy basically any SB32 device that has like Wi-Fi and Bluetooth in it. You could load their code on it. And not only do you have the ability to receive RID, but you could also transmit. And if we have any Seinfeld fans in the audience, it's a very bad thing, Jerry, very bad. So we have to follow Babu and not wish to do bad things. There's other things that you can use to decode. Again, if you have the appropriate war driving paraphernalia or other Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, sneaky James Bond stuff. If you're familiar with Wireshark, you can decode packets through there. And I've talked with Mike, who I don't know if he's listening, known as Dragorn. He's the guy behind Kismet. If anyone is into war driving and Wi-Fi stuff, you probably know what Kismet is, and it does a lot of cool stuff, and Mike continues to do amazing things with that. So again, just, you know, err on the side of caution, but, you know, this was a protocol that was kind of forced down by the government, I guess, for our safety, but people reverse engineered the different protocols, and that's why we have Open Drone Idea. So if you wanted to get under the hood of this, you can do so via our favorite open source repository on Git. So now we get into some fun. I think this is the last slide on RID. So how do we know? How do they know? Well, here's the thing. There's no network or ground stations. So how far does a Wi-Fi or Bluetooth signal travel? Even if it's on a drone at 400 feet, it's not really going to go super duper far for a lot of reasons. So there's no official ground stations. There's no plans for official ground stations, the best that I know. But hey, if we want to think like weird tinfoil hat level stuff, we all have smartphones that have internet access. I'll let you figure out if there's a way that, you know, some agency could tap your phones and find out if we're all receiving drones. I don't know. I'm just saying. But again, you know, I think what's really important here is with this mandate, and there's similar things in other parts of the world. If you see a drone and you take out your phone and you hit drone scanner and you don't see anything, I don't know, is that a good thing or a bad thing? But I think these days we all have to be kind of cautious. And I don't think, you know, a lot of people, you know, you could look at YouTube videos and whatnot. People said, oh no, RID is going to kill drones. Everyone's going to start selling them on Facebook Marketplace or whatever. Yeah, people sell drones used all the time. I don't think this is going to be the death of drones or anything like that, or, you know, in the US or elsewhere. But, you know, I think it's just important to kind of talk about like our rights of freedom and whatnot. Again, just staying on this side of the line here. But RID is something important. I think we all need to be aware of. It's another big data type of opportunity that hasn't actually materialized yet. It probably will, but we'll see what happens. Any Q&A on this? All right, right back here.
You mentioned that RID is imposed by the FAA. Are other countries doing similar things? Are there, you know, other privacy implications elsewhere versus the US leading?
Yeah, so there's lots of countries that have similar kind of mandates. You know, every country has different laws. You know, I think you can go to Mexico and just like fly a drone and nobody's probably going to care. I think that's going to depend on the country. Probably the ones that you would imagine are probably more regulated: Germany, UK, Italy, France, Australia, maybe a few others. But yeah, there's similar type of things. And that's the thing, you know, when we look at consumer device level drones, right, DJI is probably, you know, 85% or so market share. They have their own issues in the US right now. They also have issues in other countries. So yeah, you know, it's kind of driven by the device manufacturers, it's driven by countries, everyone needs to be in compliance, everyone wants to be their version of the Borg. So yeah, good question though. Yeah, so it actually is a unified standard. So, you know, I'll go back because I don't know what the number is. So ASTM F3411, that's the FAA compliance thing. So if you want to dig into that, and it's like in typical weird government nebulosity or whatever, you could look into that. But that's why I say, like, look at the Open Drone ID if you want to get into the nuts and bolts of it, because I think it does a pretty good job of unpacking to that standard. And good follow-up. Anything else? We're cruising right along here. Awesome. All right, so ADS-B and TIS and UAT. I bet most of you have probably heard of what ADS-B is, but We're doing something a little different. So this map, I'm just going to kind of let maybe go. Oh, it is going. Okay. So I think the resolution is probably bad, but basically what we're looking at, I think I did this about a week and a half ago. So in one of the major fight feeder websites, so there's all these ground stations like me and other people feed into different websites to track aircraft. And so some of them offer the ability to look at from different altitudes. And so as you start to see on this map, it started to get busier and busier. So what I did was I started at 65,000 foot, which is really where the maximum thing that things are. There were some balloons in the center of the country. I thought Project Luna was actually dead. That was one of Google's things. But apparently there's like four or five of them up there right now. So there were those that were being tracked, then aircraft. And then I went down from 65 all the way down. So we can see like there's a lot of traffic here. And now I'm coming back down the other way. So instead of going from maximum altitude, now we're going down to smallest. And so what we're going to start to see is the number of aircraft starts to diminish. So we're talking about like when we get under 2,000 feet, little like Cessna 172s and whatnot. But this was, I think, at like 11 o'clock one night that I had nothing better to do, apparently. And this is what was flying around at like 11 o'clock Eastern time. So to give an idea, there's a lot of air traffic and like 11 o'clock at night is not the peak. So I think we all know that from the previous presentation, there's all sorts of things flying around. But ADS-B is one of the major things that I think we could all track. And there's lots of things out there, but we'll get into a little bit of the details because there's been some changes and some, I don't wanna call them advancements, but some additional complexity to the national air traffic of how things get tracked. So ADS-B is what we know. The frequency for ADS-B is 1.09 gigahertz or 1,090 megahertz, whatever you want to call it. It's roughly like a 2 megahertz wide signal. So if anyone has one of the RTL-SDR dongles, you can use those to receive this. It has a 3.2 megahertz bandwidth. This is like a 2 megahertz wide signal. So you could receive ADS-B signals. That's where most of the air traffic is. And so for an ADS-B signal to work, it transmits down and various ground stations could receive that for national level stuff. But again, it's signals that are unencrypted in the clear. You know, your ground station, if you had an SDR and plugged it into your phone, if you were outside in the parking lot and you could be receiving aircraft and now you're a ground station. And then it's up to you if you want to look at that locally or send it out over the internet, share with others. But there's a lot of other things that are going on right now. So there's something else called UAT, which is at 978 megahertz. Most all large commercial aircraft use ADS-B at 1090. Smaller aircraft use UAT. UAT is only in use in the United States. There's no other countries that use that. So that probably is like another question that some of you might be thinking about. So that's like a US only thing. And I'll share that on the next slide. So there's those two. Then there's also something called TISB. So TISB is actually different, even though that this is meant to be a presentation that talks about signals coming from the sky flying. There's something called TISB. So the ground stations transmit things like weather data on the ground up to aircraft. And if you live relatively close enough to an airport, you can receive these. And so if anyone has wondered if they have received ADS-B before and they look at their what's being received, sometimes there's like these weird anomalies that, you know, just keep transmitting and transmitting, but you can't tell where they are because they're not sharing their latitude and longitude. Chances are it's one of the FAA sites. Where I live in Poughkeepsie, nearby there's three of these sites, and it always looks weird when I show people like my aircraft tracker, like why have you received 200,000 packets from this one where most aircraft are like 1,000 before they fly out of range or whatever. So TISB is something interesting. Again, if you live near an airport, that could be something extra fun to explore. So yeah, ground things need flying signals, flying things need ground signals, flying things need flying signals, and ground signals need flying signals? Question mark? Yeah, I think I kind of just needed four things there. So yeah, that's the deal here. And then just to kind of look at that a little bit more closely. So the majority of aircraft use ADS-B at 1090. So that means basically what they're doing is they are receiving their location via GPS on the aircraft. Then they're rebroadcasting many, many flight parameters temperature, airspeed. They can send out like emergency alerts. They can send all this other stuff added to that signal, as well as their location and speed and all that other stuff. So they're sending that out. And so that's when you receive something, it's coming directly from an airplane. That's what's ingested to the air traffic control system in the United States. And then they do various different things with it. That's actually quite a bit different than this new kid on the block called UAT. So UAT kind of does the same thing, you know, again, for like little private aircraft. But the way that UAT works is not only is it transmitting its signals, figuring that there's somebody on the ground that's going to be receiving it, it is also transmitting it where larger aircraft who are most likely flying at higher altitude are also not only going to receive that, but they're going to rebroadcast it. And so, for example, if anyone's here, like from Ulster County, where there's like, gliders and stuff like that, they have their own special little identifiers, which is not part of this presentation. But what you're starting to see is that they're using their UAT transponders. And because there's other aircraft that are transiting the area, you'll see them reflecting their signals back off. And so a lot of people say UAT is not that popular. It depends on when and where. And so I think that's actually kind of neat because it allows you to receive aircraft that you normally wouldn't, thanks to other aircraft in the area. So hopefully that makes a little bit more sense about what UAT is. And then also like experimental aircraft, like seaplanes and gliders and stuff like that. So, you know, you might be surprised that even just in the past couple of years, I've seen this take off quite extensively. There's a lot of cooler things showing up on my different aircraft trackers that I have at home. So hopefully this makes a little bit more sense. Yeah, airplanes, gliders, helicopters, talking commercial, civilian, military, all that good stuff. So how high does a ground station need to be? Well, as long as your ground station can see an aircraft, that's how high it needs to be. So then at that point, you just have to tell yourself, well, what's the range? And so this spiffy little graphic I created a couple of years ago, it's basically just building out to say, if you're at ground level, sea level, 10 feet, 20, 40, 60, et cetera, feet above ground level, what's your expected receive range? And then so I plotted it for two different altitudes. Most people, you're going to see diminishing returns. Once you go over like 40, 50, 60 feet, how much more range are you going to get? At that point, then you have to start going up really high. Now, unless you live on a mountain or something, you're never going to really get the max. But imagine if you're an aircraft, if you're even at just 3,200 feet, they're broadcasting on ADS-B, they're going to be received for over 200 miles. That's actually kind of neat. But again, as a ground station, you know, higher is always better, but it depends on what your goal is. If you live near an airport and you just care about stuff, you know, within 40, 50 miles of you, that's fine. Not everyone cares about, like where I live, I don't really care about seeing every aircraft that flies into JFK or LaGuardia. I just care about what's in like the next 20 or 30 miles from me. And so I'll actually decrease the receive sensitivity on some of my systems because I don't necessarily on everything want to see everything far away. So hopefully that gives a little bit of clarity. And then how do you do this? Software. So there's a bunch of different things that you can do here. Probably the most widely known, I think, is FlightAware. You can go to FlightAware website. They give you instructions for how to build a ground station. You get a Raspberry Pi, you get an SDR, they give you an image, you load it on an SD card, blah, 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 blah. They give you all the instructions, and now you can feed your output of your SDR with the right antenna to their network, and then you can see all the aircraft. And then you have all these other ones like Flight Radar 24 and the ADS-B Exchange, et cetera. So you can feed into their systems, but there's a couple issues with that. When you have a receiver that you create and you send into these systems, other people that are taking advantage of that, there's a catch. The catch is companies like FlightAware can be contacted and paid a couple extra bucks for aircraft owners like, I don't know, Elon Musk, he's been in the news with this, probably some of you have seen that. You could ask companies like FlightAware to say, hey, I want you to not track my aircraft. And they say, okay, sure, give us some money and we'll block that. So how do you know? If every one of these public sites, like for example, say if you hear some really loud airplane flying overhead and you say, oh good, I'm gonna go look at my FlightAware dashboard, your receiver might actually be seeing that data. But unless you're not looking at it a particular way, if you're relying upon the website itself to give you the data visualization, you might not even see that aircraft, even though it is transmitting ADS-B. So I think that's something really important to point out. All five of these that I list are all different. Most people who really feel like they need to be private, reach out to like anyone who has one of these kind of sites, or like the guy that kind of got in a tiff with Mr. Musk there, get into some weird legal actions or whatever, but there's a way around that. We all love that. So what if you make your own ground station? So there is software available that you can have all the data visualization that you need. So I like something called Virtual Radar Server. The only unfortunate thing, it is a Windows-only application. It's getting a little long in the tooth. Yeah, there's some ways that you can do some Linux stuff on it, but it's not as good. But then there's other ways like SDR Angel is probably my favorite software. So basically, not only can you create your own ground station, you could also log all that detail. So if I told you in the last 5 years, I have a MySQL database that has every aircraft that's ever flown within the range of my receivers. And if I wanted to say, when's the last time that I saw Air Force One make a transit to Poland, which is one of its common destinations for when whoever decides to fly to Europe to do stuff. I can tell you that. Air Force Two, you know, I can reference everything. Is it call sign AF1, AF2 versus its tail number versus a serial number? I could tell you this specific aircraft that flies which flight for JetBlue on flight 1514 or whatever. How many times did they swap one aircraft out, or versus how many times did that same exact aircraft fly the same exact route? How often did I see that receiver? Was that flight running behind or was it running ahead of schedule? I don't have the time to crunch all the data that I have, but I have the data, and I've actually set up like little fancy little alerts where I get like some VIP things that I set alerts for. So you can do some cool stuff with that within Virtual Radar Server. ADS-B Flight Tracker is something really cool where you can open up a port in something like VRS, Virtual Radar Server, and then you have an augmented reality view. So you can actually see it's translating to aircraft in real time on your phone, and then you can see them flying around on your phone. So like it's almost like a video game. So that's pretty cool. And then like SDR Angel, you can do some really advanced stuff. I have some videos on YouTube. I'm kind of like the SDR Angel fanboy, I think, on YouTube these days. But I have some videos that I've done like from Denver Airport where I was tracking aircraft as they were on the taxiway and then taking off, and you can see all this real time and do cool data viz stuff. So these are something that you can do. You can do it at home if you wanted to create like a ground station with like an antenna in your attic or roof or something. Or if you just like want to load this up like on an Android tablet, just see what's out there, you can do that. So SDR Angel software is really, really useful for ADS-B as well as the TISB and the UAT stuff. So you can do all that kind of fancy receiving stuff. And that's all I'm going to get into on the ADS-B time. And we're right on time. Any questions on this in the front? Yes, you can see everything. Everything that transmits. Now, here's the fun thing with military aircraft. Not all of them transmit their latitude and longitude all the time. They can turn that on and off. And that's really like an OPSEC type of thing for them to do that. But if you have multiple receivers, there's ways that you can triangulate them. And so even if I know like there is a particular C-135 flying somewhere within 50 miles-ish of me, since I have multiple receivers, I can do some fancy math with computers, and it'll actually tell me their location with an approximation. So the answer is yes, and the answer is like yes with an asterisk on it. Yes. Anything else? Yeah, but that's like way out of context to this. But yeah, thank you. Good question though. All right, so I know we're coming up on time. This is the last topic. So radio sons and HAB stuff. I'll go through this pretty quick. Every day in the United States, there are mostly two launches every day from 91 sites. In the US is 91, Canada has like 30, Mexico's 15. I think around globally there's about 300, I kind of lost count. But do some basic math. If there's a weather balloon launched twice a day from all of these sites, it's really like 220,000, but I felt like that number was like ridiculously big, so I kind of scaled it down to 175 plus. But that's actually pretty crazy. I think that kind of touches on a little bit about who presented before me. So there's a lot of things that are being launched, and we're just talking about just weather service balloons in the US as well as other countries. So that's what we're going to talk about. So between the 401 to 406 megahertz range is where these get launched locally up to New York, middle of Long Island, near Brookhaven and Albany are two the launch sites that are closest. And so when you launch a balloon, is my graphic working? No? Oh, boo. I had the little tire like going up and then coming down. Oh, well. Oh, there we go. Yeah, so hey. Yeah, so basically you launch a balloon, it goes up to like 80, 90, 100,000 feet, and then it comes down. If you were like a student, yeah, you do that and like hopefully the balloon doesn't drift and you get it somewhere nearby. That's not so much the goal here. So with weather services, they use this for what's called upper air observation. So they're getting data like wind direction, wind speed, temperature, and humidity. And so with a ARDC, I don't know if anyone's heard of them, they have like all this money from like 44 subnet they sold IP addresses and made a ton of money to give out and fund cool things. This is one of those cool things called Sontub. So they take all these people with ground stations based off of SDRs, they feed this in, and then you can plot all sorts of cool things. So what we're seeing here is the little tower right at like the Sontub upper right is where I live in Poughkeepsie. I'm receiving over like a 30-day period. The first reception is the green dots. Where the bursts are, there's probably like a little explosion thing, and then where did I last receive it? So you can kind of get an understanding for looking at this map. Where did I receive them? Where do they go? Where do they burst altitude? And then where do they drift? So you can pretty much see, I've only captured two of these things because they're ridiculously far. My wife doesn't want me going on crazy missions out all day. But yeah, you could receive these. That's what's pretty neat. Yeah, so you get all these cool data visualizations on the Sontub website. You have like burst altitude, speed, temperature, blah, 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 all this stuff. But if you're into like data collection, this all goes into cloud, and big data sets I think are actually pretty cool. But this is what's really cool. Who likes free stuff? I think some of us got like SanDisk media servers or something. I don't know, Ed gave me two of these. He's like, here, take these. I'm like, okay, fine. So we all love free stuff, right? So what if I told you there's like 200,000 of these balloons being launched every year. And in each one of these transmitters, which NOAA has recently changed it, they used to want you to mail it back to them because they were expensive. Well, guess what? These are less expensive now. They clearly say on the device, just dispose of it correctly. But guess what? You have an STM-based device with a GPS, with a sensor, with a battery, and all these other stuff in it. Guess what? That's like a cool thing. So it, literally, money could fall out of the sky. You capture one of these things. You could do cool things. Now, one thing that I'll preface. The first one that I captured, I got home. My wife's like, what is this? So I showed it to her. I turned the power button back on after I captured it. Guess what? Everyone in the world saw where I lived because I had a ground station at home up in my attic that's receiving these balloons. I turned that thing on and boom, it's like, wow, there's a balloon at Steve's house. So you don't want to do that. You don't want to turn those back on because once it gets a GPS lock, then it starts transmitting. So how do you prevent that? How you prevent that? This is where we get into amateur radio cult. But what do you do? There's all these cool things. It's like a real life game of Pokemon. You can catch them all. You have the Sond app on your phone. You can advertise where you are. Other people see you in your chase vehicle. Like this guy, Larry, who I know lives up in New Hampshire. He was out there yesterday, out in Las Vegas, kind of like in like Andrew Stuttland. There was this guy, he had like right pickings. There were like four balloons. Like I think he got all of them. So like, you could see like how this works. And people actually catch these, they leave notes, say, hey, you know, I knocked on the door of this guy. He said, yeah, sure, come on my property. You can get this. Other people, like I'll say that for an after story, other people are not so nice. But again, that's an after story. But again, you know, it's kind of like a cool thing. Literally, money is falling out of the sky. Go get the ability to receive these. This is what the point is. So how do you do this? Go, you get an SB32 with a little OLED screen. You 3D print a case. You put it together. Now you have like a little portable Pokemon balloon catcher thing. So you can do this. Or you can do something else. You can get the RadioSonde Auto RX, again, my favorite QR code. You can install that on a Raspberry Pi. You hook your SDR up to it, you have an antenna. Maybe you leave that at your house. Your app can look at where that is on the ground station network, and then you can see that. Or you could also take this and take it mobile with you. So there's like all sorts of really cool things that you can do to enable your ability to capture all of the rare Pokemon balloons that are landing all over the place. My friend Joe, WJ2B is his amateur radio call sign. He lives in the middle of Long Island somewhere. This past 12-month span, I think he's up to like 22 balloons that he's captured. Most of the other ones have gone into the ocean. I've only captured two because I'm not crazy and driving like all over the place. But there's people that are catching these. It's like a cool community, and then like people stay in touch and they see all their notes. So that's that. And then here's where we get into the best part: reprogramming things. Right? We all know about debug and all these other stuff. So yeah. So you connect wires here, and now you reflash it with this open source program called RS-41, which is like an older radio sonde. And then you reflash it. And then what? You convert the National Weather Service transmitter into amateur radio. So you get your license and now you launch balloons. And for anyone that I talked to and said, I'm gonna encourage you to get an amateur radio license, here's your reason why. Because you can go and capture these transmitters, reprogram them, and then turn them into your own balloon, where yes, you will have to go get your own helium and da, 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 da. I'll leave that up to you to research. I'm just talking about the transmitter part, but that's the most expensive part, save for the helium. So that's it. If you want to get your amateur license, look for Ed, Nicole, and Joe, who are floating around here, somewhere around here. They're doing ham radio tests and licenses. And so yeah, jump onto the cult. And that's pretty much it. And if anyone's interested in antenna stuff, you could look for the Lego guy some of you have seen. Ask me questions about it. And feel free to drop me emails afterwards with your commentary. Any questions on this, or are we ready to wrap it up? We're good. All right. Thank you.